Today, every GP has to focus on money creation because, as you said, cheap money is not available anymore. Multiple arbitrage is definitely much more complicated, and companies need to manage or operate in a more volatile environment. And therefore, companies need to be better at the way they operate to generate returns, to generate 2x and more returns. You need to be able to take a company from A to Z with quite a bit of a journey through that. We, as I mentioned before, we are a growth investor, and therefore most of our effort is really in driving growth for our portfolio companies. And that does mean commercial excellence, it means investing in sales teams, it means investing in marketing, it means building capacity if needed, so that the companies continue to grow. One of our co-managing partners, Deepak Patel, always says that it's better to drive one incremental point of growth than one incremental point of EBITDA margin. And that's the mantra that we use inside the firm.
For the last 30 years, private equity has been an increasingly popular destination for both institutional and also high net worth capital, and its reach has extended across multiple industries globally. Yet the level where value is actually created inside of the companies themselves, genuine operational transformation has sometimes been harder to discern. Today, the gap between financial engineering and real business improvement is under more scrutiny than ever. One organization which has been determined to show that operational change is real, not rhetorical, is Permira, and its value creation team is now a defining feature of business whose origins trace back to Schroeder Ventures in the 1990s. Permira's operating partner head of value creation is Riccardo Basile, an Italian living in London with a reputation as an important architect of value creation. And the aim today is to understand what that means in practice, from diagnosis through to execution. Riccardo, welcome to this curated edition of the Money Maze podcast.
Thank you for having me.
So you have a degree in industrial engineering and an MBA from the University of Bologna.
Correct.
I did a little work. I have been there, but the University of Bologna isn't just Europe's oldest university. It's also widely recognized as the oldest continuously operating university in the world. So that was quite
Correct.
Something. And I don't know whether this is true. Bologna is the intellectual and culinary capital of Italy.
They would say that. Not sure everybody would agree, but yes, they would say that.
So just reflecting, you start in industry, you move to consulting, and now for over a decade you've been in private equity. Just explain what motivated those steps.
Yep. So as you said, I started as an engineer in Italy, then in the UK and in Russia. And I was working on the shop floor with the operations, driving changes, mostly in post-acquisitions. The companies I was working for were very acquisitive at the time. And the moment we decided to come back to the UK, because my wife decided that UK was a better place to live than Russia or Italy, consulting felt like a natural place to go. We wanted to move to London, lots of consulting firms here in London, and therefore started working with some of the best operators in the market with a company called Alix Partners. And then the transition from consulting into PE, again, felt quite natural. I'd been transforming businesses as a consultant. I wanted to be closer to the businesses, and the role as an operating partner actually matches those two things. The variety and intellectual stimulation that you can have as a consultant, but more accountability, which I was missing as a consultant from my days in industry. And so 11 years ago, I joined the Permira team.
So let's just talk about Permira. Is there a quick recap? People, offices, assets?
We have two strategies, equity and credit. I'm mostly working with our equity investments. We have about 500 people globally. We have offices in North America, in Europe, and a small presence also in Asia. But our real focus is Europe and North America.
So 100 billion, but I think I'm right in saying only four sectors.
One of the key differentiations of Permira is that we are a multi-sector specialist. So we're only looking at really four sectors. And in those four sectors, we're only looking at specific verticals. So the four sectors are services, healthcare, consumer, and tech. But inside those four, as I mentioned, tech, we're really only looking at software and niche infrastructure. Inside consumer, we only do brand investment, Golden Goose, Hugo Boss, Doc Martens, Valentino, and digital, marketplaces, e-commerce, classified. We don't do CPG, we don't do food. Inside services, most of our investment is white-collar professional services. And inside our healthcare team, we're really looking at CDMOs, so contract manufacturers, healthcare services, and health tech.
What's the unifying theme across those four?
We are a growth investor. So we're only looking to invest in companies that are market leaders in their segments, that are growing at speed. The average, let's say, if I take the average growth in our in our portfolio from a revenue point of view, it's about 10, 12, 13% year on year. And our EBITDA growth is about 16%. So we only buy successful growing businesses, market leaders in their segments.
So I'd just like to get a sense of how you've constructed your value creating team.
With pleasure. Maybe a bit of a history, historical perspective. When I joined 11 years ago, there were three of us, and all we were doing was taking care of the, you know, the small fires that we had here and there. Every portfolio has fires. Because of taking care of those fires, because we started getting involved in some early diligence, and because the fund was also growing in size, we've been able to grow the team significantly and invest behind the team. So today there are 21 of us, and I'm actually recruiting some more roles in specific areas. And what we've done, I would say, over the past three and a half, four years, has gone beyond being what traditionally was a horizontal team. You know, we had a team of generalists, everybody with consulting and industry background, everybody with a sector affiliation. But we were operating as a horizontal team available to all of our four sectors. What we then done is actually change that model and build four mini value creation teams inside each of the four sectors. And so, you know, for each sectors, we looked at what expertise do we want to have here? What are the best experts that we want to have in-house to provide the best support for our portfolio companies in that specific sector? Go-to-market is one key area for us, given the growth focus that we have. And for that, we actually have individuals that come from tech commercial, service commercial, healthcare commercial, and then consumer commercial. Just to give an idea, the person that leads our go-to-market effort in healthcare used to be actually a real doctor, as a, you know, a surgeon, then became a McKinsey consultant for a period. And then for the 6 years before he joined us, he was running two sales organizations, first in Southern Europe and then in Asia Pacific. So we have built a team of truly functional and sector expertise inside the four sectors.
So let's just talk about PE and the extent to which it's changing. I think there is a profound shift going on. We all know about the blockages in exits. We know about the fact that the sort of the older model has evolved into something else. And this term that I've been becoming familiar with as I prepare for this interview is about value creation. So operational intensity, commercial acumen, the ability to rewire organizations. What motivated that increasing focus?
So I would say that a number of GPs, a number of investors, a number of private equity firms have been looking at value creation for many years in the past. If I take the Permira track record, we measure regularly over the past 15 years, 80% of the incremental value that we have generated in our investments is actually come from revenue growth or EBITDA margin improvement. So financial engineering, deleveraging has never been core to what Permira has done. And there are a few GPs that have been doing something similar. Now, today, every GP has to focus on value creation because, as you said, cheap money is not available anymore. Multiple arbitrage is definitely much more complicated. And companies need to manage or operate in a more volatile environment. And therefore, companies need to be better at the way they operate. To generate returns, to generate 2x and more returns, you need to be able to take a company from A to Z with quite a bit of a journey through that. We, as I mentioned before, we are a growth investor, and therefore most of our effort is really in driving growth for our portfolio companies. And that does mean commercial excellence. It means investing in sales teams. It means investing in marketing. It means building capacity if needed, so that the companies continue to grow. One of our co-managing partners, Deepak Patel, always says that it's better to drive one incremental point of growth than one incremental point of EBITDA margin. And that's the mantra that we use inside the firm.
Okay. So would it be fair to say it's become a system?
It needs to become a system, yes. It needs to become a system. It needs to be part of the way PE works.
Okay. And that, of course, made me think that despite the differences of the companies you examine and invest in, is there pattern recognition?
Yes and no. There is, because we look at the same sectors, we look at specific sectors, and therefore we're able to build the experiences in those segments that we look at. But also there isn't, because all of our portfolio companies have different maturity levels, have different sizes, have different management teams. So what we try to build is a mechanism that enables us to see each individual company as an individual company and then tailor the approach so that it best delivers what is needed for that specific company. No value creation, no two value creations are the same across of our portfolio companies.
Okay. So let's talk at the coal face. Mm-hmm. You are looking at this company, so it's a newly acquired company. What are the first two or three signals that tell you whether value creation will come from operational uplift or commercial acceleration or a strategic reset?
Yep. Actually, I would say we start doing that before we acquire a business. So something that now most GPs are moving towards is exactly that. The value creation team, the portfolio team, the operations team, different names in different GPs, are now getting involved earlier and earlier. The team at Permira is now involved in origination. When we look at a new segment, when we look at a new company, we are involved in those early discussions. Myself or somebody from my team tends to be meeting the management team, maybe not the first time that they ever meet Permira, but the second time. And so we work on assessing the business, assessing the baseline, and then assessing the potential already in diligence. So that when we underwrite, when we go to our investment committee with the reasons why we should buy this business, the value creation is already built in what we want to do. And that is really on two elements. The first one is, do we need to invest more in the baseline, in the infrastructure? Is the company mature enough, or do we need to bring new individuals, new capabilities, new competences? And the second element is, once we've done that, what else could the company do? You know, our businesses tend to grow. We're only buying growing businesses. What we want to do is accelerate their growth. And so what do we want to put in place so that we can deliver that acceleration in growth? And that is all done in diligence. Once we acquire a business, then we take the work that we've done in diligence, we sit down with the management team and go through that and build what used to be called the 100-day plan. I hate the name 100-day plan because things don't get done in 100 days. Things take longer. You know, a value creation plan is something that a business should have always in front of them for 2, 3, 4, 5 years. And therefore, we build that plan with the management team, and then we help them execute initiative by initiative.
And is it difficult? You can look at the numbers, you can have a feeling for, you know, the industry in question, but of course, it's kind of back to your analogy of being on the shop floor. It's often when you're actually only in the engine room that you discover things aren't quite as you thought.
So, yes, there are certain things that we discover only after we own the business. But because we look at many companies, because in the team we have expertise that is specific to those functional areas, those industries, we build pattern recognition. We build, we know what to look for, and we can smell if there are opportunities or need for investment. Now, nevertheless, it happens that maybe 20% of what we put forward in the investment case has to be adjusted because, I said the cold face of the morning shows you something a bit different.
And could you give us an example or two of, transactions where you and your team have been particularly sort of at work?
Let's take a recent investment, a company called Westbridge. They're based in Germany, but they operate across the entirety of Europe. They are an energy broker for the real estate industry. So they help real estate owner buy energy, gas, electricity, mostly some water. This is a very relatively small company, and we really saw the opportunity to drive and more of that growth. I was involved in the diligence phase. We wanted to assess the opportunity to continue to sustain that level of growth. We wanted to understand the strength of the management team, given the age of the business. And we wanted to understand what else we could do with that business from a pricing point of view, from an internationalization point of view, what are the products we could include in their portfolio, what M&A we could do. The moment we closed, which was in March in 25, we started working closely with the management team. And we discovered that not only the things that we saw were confirmed, but actually we found the opportunity to drive in more growth and more results. So in that case, we decided to increase the size of the team from my side that was going to be involved. And so today, in addition to me helping them with the overall strategy, we brought in one person to look at their technology infrastructure. And we took what was a fairly very old-fashioned, very manual company, and really driving it hard to the new world. The business, until our investment, was really operating on Excel and emails. And in 6 months after that, having spent time with the management team, we launched a program to digitize the end-to-end processes. And what was the value that we brought to them? I'm sure that's what the key question. You know, at the end, we're not the management team. We have great management team. We reinforce the management team on technology in this specific case. The value there was, I would say, twofold. The first one is give them clarity on what they want to focus on, helping them define what they had to invest in, what they wanted to develop, and what they didn't want to develop. Until our involvement, they were trying to do certain things, but without that level of clarity, and therefore resources were being not wasted, but not optimized. And the second element was we gave them the ability to invest heavily. So we gave them permission to go and invest 15 million euros into new individuals, new technologies, so that they could accelerate that the technology path. And within 6 months, we were able to launch our first MVP, minimum viable product. Within 9 months, we launched a customer portal, something that our customers are very, very interested in. The second element that we really focus our attention has been the commercial side. So this was, when we acquired the business, an organization that was really reliant on the founders for its sales. It was growing a lot, great network, the market leader in Europe, but very reliant on the three founders. They were still in the business, but wanted to start retiring or semi-retiring. So one person in my team, Derek, is spending a lot of time with them to completely build from scratch the sales organization of the future. And we are building the target operating model, the compensation, the quota, the structures, the go-to-market approach, the marketing material, and we are hiring 75 salespeople. And so in addition to competencies that somebody like Derek was able to bring, we, as an investor, gave them the ability to spend a lot of money in hiring expensive salespeople, which have, because of the nature of the business, quite a long lead time between hiring and, you know, seeing the revenue on the ground. And we helped them do all of that.
So I'm getting the impression that people are being parachuted in selectively. I mean, typically give me a sense of how, you know, what the integration is of your folks with their folks.
Yeah, so what we tend to do is to have one person that is there in diligence and shepherds the value creation throughout the process. In the case of Westbridge, that would be me. But then, in this case, me would bring the right experts when we have to go deep. Now, Derek was actually involved, the person is doing the go-to-market work, was actually involved in diligence as well. So he had already started building a relationship with the management team. The reason why I mention relationship with the management team, because that's critical. We are not successful unless the management team is successful. And therefore, the more we can help the management team in their work, in delivering the results, the more impactful we can be. And the fact that we are involved in diligence means that we are part of the deal from the very beginning. We are part of the furniture from the very beginning. And we try to do that consistently. So now that the team has the size and scales that we have today, 21 individuals, all of our investments that are going through the second investment committee now have one of us on the ground being that shepherd, that quarterback from a value creation point of view.
Well, you've hinted at it. And one of the things I don't think people understand is necessarily the motivation of the seller, because the seller isn't always an outright seller. So why do people come to you?
Very many reasons, but one of the ones that I tend to prefer is where the seller understands that we can bring incremental value to their organization compared to what they can do by themselves. And that's why I was mentioning earlier, very often we are in the second meeting that a seller has, that a management team has, a founder has with Permira, one of us is involved so that we can present what value add we can bring. And that can be technology, that can bring commercial excellence, that can be integration experience. We can have them do M&A, pricing and packaging, really depending on the specific situation.
Okay. If we take a step back to the opportunity set, as you describe, Permira has operated both sides of the Atlantic, essentially, and I think it's a fairly even balance between the two. We read a lot about the dysfunctionality in Europe and, you know, a lot of the opportunities that might have materialized but haven't. Talk a little bit about the opportunity set and where it's richer.
I would say in Europe, we tend to see companies that are maybe less mature, especially on the commercial side. I think Europe has some of the best manufacturing, some of the best operations, because of culture, because of the way we Europe operates. We tend to see selling as an art or selling as something you have to do compared to the US, where selling is really seen as a science. And so one of the areas that we're really helping our companies with in Europe is stepping up that go-to-market, and for that we tend to bring people that have done that in the US. On the flip side, I would say in the US we see more opportunities to go deep in specific optimization opportunities. So, you know, cost, operations, building infrastructure, looking at offshoring or nearshoring, investing in technology to drive efficiencies, which don't tend to be delivered as much in the US. I'm generalizing a lot here because each company is very different.
But if you were going to bet where more opportunities come in the next 5 years, where might it be?
So from an investment point of view, I still think that we will continue being 50-50 between US and Europe. Maybe more companies in Europe, but they tend to be smaller. And therefore, from an AUM point of view, asset under management that you deploy, 50-50 between US and Europe. There are great companies in the US where we can still add lots of value. Recently, in the past couple of years, we made investments in Zendesk, market leader in customer service solutions. Listed business, very large business. Nevertheless, we took it private, and the value we're generating there through new management team, extra support to growth, extra investment in AI, investment in technology has been great. So we'll continue doing those things, and we continue investing in more mid-cap companies in Europe where the opportunity is more because they are less mature and they are early in their professionalization journey.
So let's walk on through that value creation towards a later time where the execution has, hopefully materialized in the right outcomes. How do you think about the exits? Now, there's a timeline on some of those funds, but there's also the dilemma that some of these are very good businesses or the execution may have taken longer. So talk me through that next stage.
So that's a very multifaceted decision, because as you said, when we look at our businesses, we're investing in growing businesses, we need to return money to our investors, and therefore eventually we want to exit our portfolio companies. When we take a decision to exit a business, we consider both the specific situations of the portfolio companies. Have they delivered, you know, the optimal growth rate that we want to deliver? But also, we need to take into consideration how is our fund performing overall. And therefore, on a yearly basis, we look at which portfolio company should we consider to exit in the next 12, 18, 24 months. If we decide that a portfolio company should be exited in, let's say, 12 months or 18 months, then we start putting in place a number of initiatives to prepare the exit process. Now, that doesn't mean that we haven't really been pushing the value creation until then. You know, value creation is, as I mentioned before, a constant process. We always have driving value. We're always driving initiatives, whether because they are still not complete or because we added them halfway through our investment. But the process of exiting requires let's say, preparing the story that we want to tell the potential new buyers. And so my team gets quite involved in the exit process. We help the management team prepare what we call the exit value creation, which is practically, it's our, you know, letter to the new investors about what we would do if we were to keep that business. Our exits in the past months have been very successful. We've exited over 12 billion euros, including our co-investors, also because we've been able to present the new investors about what we were doing on technology and how that, in our opinion, was going to be value add for the companies going forward.
Now, the problem of big organizations is they get beset by matrices of responsibility. Now, you have partners who might bring the deal along. You are involved in some, not all of them. At the end, when you're analyzing the results and the contributions, how do you manage to weight contributions?
I don't like to do it. And the reason is because otherwise you start counting, you know, beans instead of looking at the overall success of the investment or not. It's very difficult to say whether this was the management success, whether it was the investment team success, whether the value creation team. It's easy to do it individually. Maybe, yes, somebody in my team got involved and we took cost out by 10 million, or the management team was brilliant and was able to deliver X. But a company is an organism that requires every piece to work correctly. And therefore, you know, I don't tend to like to start apportioning benefits or, you know, to start apportioning value or blame to the individual parts of the three constituents that work together. The management team is clearly driving the bus in this case. We are helping them to drive that. But I don't tend to split between the two.
So whilst it looks very clear in terms of the ambition and the execution, life doesn't always work like that. Let's talk a little bit about what you've learned when it doesn't go to plan.
Dostoevsky said every successful marriage is boring, because to be successful in a marriage, everything has to work. So
was that Crime and Punishment or the Brothers Karamazov?
I think it's Brother Karamazov, I think. But I'll find the quote exactly. I need to. Anyway, when things don't go well, there are a few learnings. I think that, you know, not everything works. And if everything works, it means that we're not pushing hard enough. We're not taking enough risks in our investments. What have we learned from the things that don't go well? The first one is that macro, the volatility of the macro has a big impact. And clearly, the last 6 years have created incremental volatility compared to the previous 10, 15. And businesses that maybe felt resilient pre-COVID, you know, they were not as resilient as they are today. Now, we've also been surprised on the positive side. Yeah, portfolio companies where we felt when inflation came in, or where, you know, the war in Ukraine or the war in Iran started, that could be more affected. So we've been positive surprised. But overall, macro has been one of the reasons why we have had some challenges in the past.
So as you've reviewed these businesses, in your experience, is there one particular lever of value creation that stands out above all the others?
Oh, I'm not sure. I would say M&A tends to be a lever that works in most cases. I would say focusing on go-to-market and investing in the sales organization tends to work in most cases. If there are the opportunities to invest in technology, depending clearly on the sector, that tends to work, especially today. But to say that there is one thing that is always work and that will always work is very difficult.
Now, I do know that you've described a German company that you acquired as pan-European. You're an Italian. You're operating in all these different theatres. To what extent do you need locals or local speakers to affect change, particularly if you're talking about mid-cap businesses?
We do need that in certain situations. I would say most of our companies are international. They are based in you know, in Germany, in Italy, in France, but they tend to have an international audience. Very often we help them grow their international audience. But some management teams can need or require a bit more of a local flavor. We have a company in Italy called Gruppo Florence. The company is truly international. They ship everywhere Chanel sells, everywhere Dior sells, but it's really an Italian company. In that case, the entire investment team and the entire value creation team is actually Italian speakers, because it would be more complicated. They do speak English, but it's more complicated. Now, the key element, though, is that we see the geographical lens as a secondary lens. Our main lens at Permira for investment, for the value creation, is actually the sector. Do we know the sector well? Now, in the case of Gruppo Florence, the partner in charge of it is the head, the co-head of the consumer team. He's also based in Italy. But the main reason why he's the partner in charge of it is because he co-heads the consumer team. So sector first, language second.
So I got the impression when I was looking at your materials that you haven't, as an organization, appeared to have as much difficulty in the sales as the industry generally has. Is that fair? And talk a little bit about this, because the sale can be a sale to another entity or it can be a listing. And traditionally, we learnt a lot about listings. Just give me a lens on what is happening at the exits and how you think about what works best.
I think successful businesses, growing businesses, market leaders see a premium at exit. You know, we buy businesses that continue to grow under our ownership, growing before, accelerate their growth today. They are great businesses. They retain the market leadership role. And therefore, that's a place where today investors really want to put their capital to work. You know, we don't do heavy restructuring. We don't try to squeeze the cost as much as possible. And then who knows what happens after. So because you buy quality, because we want to make great business even greater, you are selling even more quality at exit. And therefore, we see that in our exit processes. I would say all of our recent exits have been businesses where the new buyer had valued incrementally, you know, purchased, has decided to pay a higher multiple because of the value that we had generated. The two co-managing partners always say, we don't build bigger businesses, we build better businesses. And that's why I think that we can exit them in the current environment.
And is there a sort of a pattern where more of them are sold to other businesses as opposed to being listing? What I'm getting at is, under what circumstances do you decide that the stock market listing is the better route?
Sector, size, the level of interest from the stock market versus the potential investors. I don't have the math, the stats in my head exactly, but I would say at the moment, a third has been secondaries, i.e. an exit to another sponsor, a third strategic, and a third IPOs. Clearly that changes depending on the year. We haven't done an IPO over the past couple of years for obvious reasons. We've been very successful in selling assets to strategics, for example, Informatica to Salesforce, or to secondaries. I would say it's really company specific because of the sector, the interest, the size of the company itself.
Well, we talked about the whole engineering process that takes place. The question I hadn't asked you is the identification of the targets. Mm-hmm. I mean, not everybody's knocking at your door every week saying we want to talk to you. So talk me a little bit through how you identify and start that conversation.
Yeah, so as I mentioned very early on, we are sector focused. We really want to be sector insiders. And to do that, my, say, investment professional colleagues, they're really spending hours, weeks, days, years exploring each specific segment. And that makes them really understanding what's happening out there. I'll give you an example. There was a company that we invested in. There is a company we invested in Italy, a company called Kedrion. They are a specialty pharmacy player. They produce medicine from human plasma. And there was the opportunity to acquire, they had the number 4 in the market. There was an opportunity for them to acquire number 5, which is a UK business called BPL. The family that owned Kedrion didn't have the capital to do that. They decided to need a partner. They knocked at our door to partner because Silvio Terry, who leads the healthcare team globally, she had been building a 10-year relationship with this family and therefore understood the market, understood them, understood what they were looking to do, great network of potential management teams that was needed in order to then do the transaction. Therefore, when the opportunity came up, we were, in inverted commas, the obvious partner for the Marcucci family to partner with. So the level of inside knowledge that you need to have today to make an investment in private equity is super high.
And even though you talked about the macro uncertainties, obviously, can present headwinds. If you just look at the playing field of corporate opportunities, how excited are you about the opportunity in a world where disintermediation and digitization and, you know, all these other things is going on to be able to effect change?
I think it's a great opportunity for many of our portfolio companies and potential new portfolio companies. If you are the market leader, if your market share is high compared to your competitors, if you are investing in technology, you can take advantage of technology and push further your market leading position. So we actually see the value of incumbency at the moment as quite high. You can invest yourself or you can buy some of the more native AI companies today and add them to your market leading position. So I think the opportunity is very interesting. I think there is also a lot to be done in corporate carve-outs. We've done, I would say, 10, 11 corporate carve-outs over the past 10 years. I think it's time we do another couple. And there will be opportunities in the market because some corporate might decide to divest some of their less core assets. And then the opportunity will be of combining this, you know, maybe market leader coming from the corporate world with some smaller companies and create a digitally native and digitally enabled market leader.
So I can't leave this interview without stepping above the noise surrounding private equity and just say, what's your perspective on the private equity industry on the next, you know, looking out 5 years beyond the current questions that have been raised?
I would say I see continued growth in the private markets. There are a number of companies that will continue to thrive better in a private setting than they are in a public setting. The private market will continue to grow. But in order to grow, it needs to deliver value. It needs to really add value to the companies that that we invest in. And that has to be through allocating resources and then providing resources and targeting the performance, pushing for that performance that the companies have the ability to deliver.
Great. Well, Ricardo, it's been very, very informative today to understand exactly what value creation means beyond a label, why it's become so embedded in your approach and why in a world where private equity is clearly having to adapt to new strains and forms of accountability that, you know, maybe it didn't have to, you'd be quite so subject to, I take three specific things is that geographically, you are finding as many opportunities in the US as you are in Europe. Number two is that whilst you as Permira as a firm focuses on four specific sectors, there's no shortage of growth. And number three is that, you know, private companies are not just here to stay. They are going to, for some, just be a better place than the public market. So the coexistence, you know, will continue. So it's been terrific to talk to you today. And thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you, Simon, for having me.